Well, it's great to be with everyone today. I want to say hello to everyone joining us online and at our other campuses. Specifically, I just want to address our Fishers campus right now. I hope you guys are enjoying your new digs. I was there on Thursday, was able to walk around. It just looks absolutely incredible. And glad you could be with us today at all of our locations. If you grab a Bible and turn to Mark chapter 6, that is the passage we're going to be in together today. And if you are somewhat new to our church, since the beginning of the year, we are spending most of the year working our way through the Gospel of Mark, just chapter by chapter, verse by verse. We're calling the series The Urgent Kingdom, and then dividing it into like seven mini-series, seven parts. And if we stay on schedule, I was looking at it this week, we will finish the Gospel of Mark the weekend of December 12th and 13th, just in time for Christmas. Now, today, we are wrapping up part three of the series before breaking for the summer. We've got a couple summer series that we're going to do. We have some incredible guest preachers that are coming in the first, all of June and then the first part of July. You don't want to miss any one of them. They're just going to really encourage us a great deal. I can't wait to hear their messages. And then in late July, early August, we'll hear from some of our pastors on staff. And then I actually start a 12-week sabbatical beginning May the 25th. I'm going to tell you more about that here in just a minute. Now, our text today is Mark chapter 6, verses 30 to 44. If you've grown up in church, if you are somewhat of a student of the Bible, you likely are familiar with this passage. And if you're not, that's okay. But this is the passage that covers the feeding of the 5,000. And I've actually titled the message, When You're Not Enough Becomes More Than Enough. Now, I don't know what your relationship is with the words not enough, but I have a long history with them going all the way back to my childhood. And I was trying to think about it this last week, like when did my relationship, somewhat unhealthy relationship, with the words not enough begin? And as near as I can tell, it began when I was in the backseat of my parents' car on long road trips with my younger sister. And I've got one younger sister, and I don't know if any of you are like me, like on long road trips. Did any of you ever do this? Did any of you ever create like an imaginary dividing line between you and them? And you're like, okay, your stuff stays on that side, and do not cross over this invisible line into my airspace. And my sister always would. Like her things and her stuff like would always cross that line. And I would complain to mom and dad, and I would be like, I don't have enough room. And then that's kind of kicked off my relationship with these words where it's like I didn't have enough as a kid. I didn't have enough toys. I didn't have enough friends. I didn't have enough time. And then it would kind of drift into my adolescent years where I would start to wonder, like, am I athletic enough? Am I liked enough? Am I handsome enough? Am I smart enough? And then it drifted into high school and beyond, like, am I athletic enough? Am I smart enough? Am I confident enough? Am I humble enough? Am I rich enough? Am I generous enough? Am I friendly enough? Am I funny enough? Am I serious enough? And thus began my relationship, my unhealthy relationship with the words not enough. I'm just wondering if any of you have a long history with those words. I bet you do. In fact, on your way in at all of our locations, you should have been handed a small piece of paper and a pen. I want to encourage you to pull that out. And if by chance you're the kind of person that just doesn't like to play along, we'll give you one more chance. You can just raise up your hand and somebody will pass you a piece of paper. Or by chance, if you've already stuck your gum in the paper, like we'd be happy to give you another piece of paper. What I want to ask you to do, just full participation here, and this is for you and you alone. Nobody else is going to see this. Is I want you just to take a few moments and I want you to think of a word or maybe a short phrase that would describe you're not enough. And maybe this is something that has been years of struggle, maybe it's a recent thing, whatever your age and stage in life, what is the primary thing right now that you is just sort of like haunting you, like you just don't know if you're enough? Now, let me help you write this down on a piece of paper, is when life asks more of you than what you think you can offer, that's your answer. When life is asking more of you than what you think you can answer, that's you're not enough, and that's the space where we can be really vulnerable to the lies of an enemy. Now, the Bible tells us that Satan is a deceiver and he is a tempter, but he's also an accuser. And what he'll do is he'll find that area of a weakness in your life, that in that area of not enough, and he'll exploit it for his purposes. And it makes us susceptible to these lies from Satan, where it will ironically keep you and me from the source of what is truly enough. However, there's a positive side to this too. When life asks more of you than what you think you can offer, then welcome to being a human being. And when we can get honest about that, realize that we don't have enough and we can't be enough, and that's okay, we are in a prime position to then receive the truth that our Creator wants us to receive. In fact, Paul was really wrestling with this whole thing of not enough in his second letter to the Corinthians, and he's dialoguing about it, and in parentheses in verse 9, these are the words of God to Paul, where he says, "My grace is sufficient for you." And here's why: my power is made perfect in weakness. And so from that, then Paul then concludes this: therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses. And you just got to stop right there and go, man, who does that? Like in our culture today, who boasts in their weaknesses? No, what are we trained to do? We're trained to diminish our weaknesses, hide our weaknesses, make excuses for our weaknesses, sweep our weaknesses under the rug. We can't be honest about them. But he goes, no, I'll boast about my weaknesses. And here's why: so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Man, what an incredible statement. A statement that you should memorize. A statement that we should have out in front of us, because it's so countercultural and counterintuitive. That in our moments of not enough, in our moments of weakness, that we could actually lean into that. And the reason why is that creates space for the power of Christ to rest upon me and work within me. And I find it interesting that he phrases it that way: rest upon me. How good would it be just to receive the power of Christ in the midst of our weakness? So as we're wrestling through this, like not enough, I want you to write that down on a piece of paper. We're going to do something with it here at the end of the service. You can fold it up. Nobody else needs to see it. And by the way, like, we're not going to post these. I'm not going to have you come across the stage and read it or anything like that. It's for you. It's between you and God. And I want you to understand this. This is the premise that we've got to start from, is that our error as a human being is that maybe we overestimate how good we really are and miss our need for the gospel, or we underestimate our worth to God and we end up missing the power of the gospel. So as a premise, we gotta start with this, is that we are a part of creation. And because of that, the Bible says that God has imprinted his likeness upon us. We are image bearers of God. And so we start from this premise that because of that and that alone, long before, this isn't anything you contribute, this isn't your ability, this isn't what you have, God says, you're enough. You're valued by me. In fact, if any of you were doubting that and you wanna know, like, well, how do you know that? Then you go to the cross, because Christ, God declared through Christ on a cross the kind of worth and value you have, that you are enough. So you gotta begin with that premise. But yet at the same time, we are fallen and enslaved to sin, that God's gotta free us from that. And so we've gotta fully surrender to him. And he has a track record of taking what we have, whatever it is at the time, he just wants our availability, and then taking what we have and making it more than enough. We see that in our passage today. Jesus' disciples were just as susceptible as you and I are to the lies from an enemy, which put them in a position to also receive these deep truths from Jesus as well. Now, if you've been with us during this series, you might recall over the last couple of weeks, especially as we've been marching our way through chapter 5, is that Jesus and the disciples, man, they've been busy. They've been working, man. They've been running and gunning. And they've been traveling all over the place, from Capernaum to the other side of the Sea of Galilee and back, and then to Jesus' hometown. And the disciples are with Jesus, watching him do all of these incredible miracles, preach these amazing sermons, and casting out all these gnarly demons. And now, from a couple weeks ago, it was their turn. If you recall, Jesus is like, hey, this is my global enterprise. Before the Great Commission to go and make disciples and taking this around the world, how about we go village to village? So he sends them out on their first mission trip, two by two, to the local villages to do what he had been doing, which is a great description of discipleship, by the way. That's what a disciple is. A disciple is watching what Jesus did and then doing what Jesus did in obedience to him. And so now it's their turn to go out two by two without Jesus and do the things that they saw him do. And I'm sure that they didn't do it nearly as good. It's kind of like learning a new skill. And maybe you go back to school, or maybe you hire a coach, or maybe if you're like me, you're trying to figure out how to do something, you go on YouTube. Anybody? And you watch the expert do the thing. You watch the expert build the cabinet, swing the golf club, draw the picture, make the sales call, change the diaper. You're like, okay, I got it. I watched the expert do the thing. And now you go to do the thing, and you're all thumbs. You don't do it nearly as well, or is that just me? I would imagine the disciples, they'd been watching Jesus do all these things, and now he sends them out, and I'm sure that their sermons weren't nearly as powerful. Their miracle working wasn't nearly as impressive. Their demon casting didn't nearly have the same effect, and I would imagine that there was some comparison going on, and I just bet you, the disciples were going, I don't know if I'm enough. And it's exhausting. Not to mention the weight that they were carrying, because their acquaintance and friend, John the Baptist, had just been put to death a few verses ago. And so now they're going, whoa, this is serious. And so by the time we get to our passage today, chapter 6, verse 30, it's been a long run. It's been a productive season. They have accomplished a lot, but they are likely tired and they are likely fatigued and in a vulnerable spot. They are tired physically, spiritually, and emotionally. Now, I have mentioned to you throughout this series that Mark's favorite word is immediately. He mentions it 40 times in his gospel alone, but in our passage, that word is never mentioned. In fact, Mark's going to do something a bit out of character for him. He's going to slow this story way down, and he's going to give us much more detail than he normally gives us, and I think there's a reason. Look at the passage with me in your Bible, starting in verse 30. It says, the apostles returned to Jesus. Returned from where? Returned from their mission trip that they just went village to village. And they gave him a report. They told him all that they had done. That's productivity. And taught. That's ability. And then Jesus says this to them. This is his response. Come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest a while. For many, and we can pause right there, many, we're going to find out in the passage in just a moment, was 5,000 men, and they didn't count the women and the children, so it's probably upwards of 15 to 20,000 total. So that's who we're talking about here. Many, these crowds, were coming and going, and they had no leisure to even eat. Get the picture that the crowds are around the disciples demanding things of them, so much so they couldn't even take a break to eat a sandwich. And so, it says in verse 32, they went away in the boat to a desolate place by themselves. See, Jesus knew that in this moment, they needed rest and retreat after a tiring run and the continuing pressure of the people. Just like all of us do at times. Whether you're, obviously, like not all of us are in vocational ministry, but whatever your role is in life. Because I guarantee you've got responsibilities, you've got people depending upon you. And so here's what Jesus is saying. He's saying to them, before the demands of life isolate you, let's go seek some solitude. Hey, before you get caught up in giving yourselves to others, which is a noble task and you should do that, but let's make sure that you're operating out of a place where you have something worth giving to them. Hey, before all the tasks and the requests and the demands of your time bury you, let's get your head above water and remember who you are apart from those things that you're producing and doing. Here's what Jesus is saying. Before exhaustion gets the best of you, let's go intentionally seek what's best for you. It's this concept of Sabbath rest. Now, I'm going to break that down in a minute, that Sabbath can be like a longer extended time, and then it can be a shorter period of time. That's why I like to think of it as rhythms of Sabbath. And rhythms of Sabbath can happen daily, it can happen weekly, or quarterly, or annually, but the concept is there, that it keeps you replenished, and it keeps you from that rat race of trying to find your identity in the thing you do. Or in the thing that you produce. Because if you do that, then you're setting yourself up for failure. I don't care what you do. If you're a stay-at-home mom or dad, you're finding your identity, that very, very noble thing. Well, then what happens, though, then when your kids grow up and leave? Then who are you? We have a number of people that are involved in amateur and professional sports in our church, and I've had lots of conversations with them. It's like, hey, off the court or off the field, who am I? Or if I get hurt and I no longer do the thing, then who am I? And if we find ourselves getting our identity wrapped up in our career or the things that we do, While it is a noble task, it was never meant to be your identity. I mean, if that's your identity, so you got to take Sabbath rest to recalibrate so that you're not confusing what you do with who you are and you're staying replenished so that you're operating out of a place of health. Does that make sense to anybody? None of that is in my notes. I couldn't even repeat that to you right now if I tried. And so, and we see that God set the example for this in Genesis chapter 2. Genesis chapter 2, this Sabbath rest is his idea. Look at what it says. I'll just read it for you, these two verses. On the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it, God rested from all his work that he had done in creation. I got a question for you. Do you think that God needed a rest because he was in danger of burning out? No, he's God. So why did he do this Sabbath rest? Well, to model it for us and to establish a precedent for us, because he knew that not only could we work ourselves to burn out, we often will. So he says, hey, let me just kind of work this in. Now, it's important to also know that this is prior to sin entering the world. So we see that work in and of itself is good and holy. Work is not the result of sin. Work can be cursed by sin, but work preceded sin. That's important to know. So work is good and holy, and God worked really, really hard, and then he Sabbathed really, really intentionally. So in Mark chapter 6, Jesus, who is God in the flesh, by the way, is urging the disciples to do what he modeled back in Genesis 2. And he says, hey guys, I want you to work really hard. We have been on a tour of ministry together. I've just sent you out two by two to do the things that you've seen me do. And now it's time to come away and rest a while. We find these three observations right out of the text. If you're taking notes, you might write these down so that you can go back through and just kind of contemplate this or have a conversation with your group or your family. Number one, Sabbath rest has got to be intentional. It's not going to be accidental. You're not just going to stumble into it. You got to plan for it. Jesus said in verse 31, let's come away by ourselves. It took some intentional effort for them to get away from the crowds. Be intentional. Number two, you got to be proactive. You proactively initiate it before you hit the wall, not after. I don't know how many times as a pastor I've had people come to me and say, could you meet with me? And already the engine's blown. And it's kind of like, no, wait a second. Like, we need to, you don't take a rest or go on Sabbath because you've burned out. You go on Sabbath so that you don't burn out. It's like preventative maintenance. And time off or time away isn't going to be like some sort of magical like elixir to fix you. I heard somebody say one time like this, time off won't work if the problem is the way you spend time on. And if you ever go on vacation, you come back from a vacation and you're like, I need a vacation from the vacation. I'm like more exhausted now after, because like we've been running and going and setting the agenda and all that's great and good. But just because sometimes we think that time away from what we do will actually fix us, when actually the problem is the way that we are when we're on time on, because we're working at an unsustainable pace, and actually, realistically, we're finding our identity in the wrong thing. Number three is it's got to be somewhat extended. It's going to require some time. Jesus said to the disciples, hey, let's go away. And Mark doesn't say that the disciples asked this, but I would imagine they probably did, or at least thought it. Like, well, how long? And he's like, I don't know, a while. A while. I don't know if any of you are like me, but when I take a little bit of time away, I've learned that it takes me, because I'm running at such high capacity, like I'm on the go a lot, it takes me about 2 weeks, especially mentally and emotionally, to even begin to like cool the jets and calm down. And after about, it takes me, in other words, here's another way to say it. It takes me about 2 weeks to prepare to go on vacation for 2 weeks. And then I realized, like, at the end of the 2 weeks, like, hey, wait a second. I'm actually way more tired than what I thought I was. And it's going to take some time. It's going to take some time for me to detox off the drug of achievement. It's going to take me some time to actually remove myself from that thing that, quite honestly, where I've maybe turned a really good, noble thing, like a career or a calling, into an idol, and I just haven't been honest about it. And I got to remove myself from the thing to recalibrate my perspective. In God's providence, I did not plan it this way, I promise, This passage is the last one that I will preach before leaving on my 12-week sabbatical this summer. Now, if you're relatively new to our church, every summer, usually between like Memorial Day and 4th of July, I take what's called a summer study break, which is not a sabbatical. It gets confused a lot, and I can understand why. But a summer study break is where basically I'm still working 40, 50 hours a week, but I'm just not preaching on the weekends because I'm taking that 15 to 20 hours of sermon prep that I would take during the week and just redirecting it to other things. And this is, unless you've just done it, and I know we have a number of people that are former pastors or in vocational ministry, unless you've done it, it's just hard to explain, is that the spiritual weight of doing what I'm doing right now is a lot heavier than what you might think. That actually the time to like prepare a message and then to physically deliver it, that's not the hardest part about it. It's the spiritual weight that comes with it. And that can be quite taxing. There are times where I just like need to like step outside of that and need to redirect that to other things. That's usually what a summer study break is. But a sabbatical is different. Every 5 years, we have a policy where all of our pastors on staff, but specifically our elders ask me to lead out in this. They ask me to step away and outside of my role and responsibilities here as lead pastor for roughly 12 weeks for the purpose of rest, but the rest isn't the primary thing. I think the biggest thing is recalibration to my identity. Because all of us, I think, have a tendency to probably latch onto our abilities or our careers or the things that we do, and then it gets real convoluted and we begin to find our identity in that thing. And that can be dangerous for any of us. It can be really dangerous for a pastor to do. I remember talking to an older man who was a retired pastor. He's in his, probably in his 90s now, but he was in his 80s then. And he said, Aaron, some of the most bitter, disillusioned people that I know are retired pastors. And that surprised me. And I was like, why is that? And he said, well, couple of reasons, but the most prominent one is that their identity had gotten wrapped up in what they did every weekend or upon the platform or the stage. And then they were surprised at how quickly their people forgot about them once they retired. And he said this, hit me like a ton of bricks. He goes, you better start preparing yourself for irrelevance now because it's coming. I was like, whoa, all right. Want to order dessert? I mean, it's like, so, but he's right. He's right. And that's not true just for those in ministry. That's true for you as well. Here's the deal, man, is that I don't want my identity wrapped up in what I do for God. I think a periodic time outside of my role, weight, and responsibilities here helped me to be reminded of a couple things. Number one, to remind myself that first and foremost, I do not have value to God because I preach sermons or do ministry or lead anything, but I have value to God for just being a son of the King. It's like, hey, just let me just like relish with you in that. Like, I'm not trying to achieve anything, not trying to do anything. Number two, to be a husband to my wife, number three, to be a father to my kids, and then a pastor to all of you as a distant fourth. Don't you feel loved? But I think that's important to understand. Now, on my sabbatical, I'm just sharing this with you because I think oftentimes when we think about sabbaticals or pastors leaving on sabbatical, it's like, oh no, there's something wrong, or what's he doing anyway? Is he interviewing for other jobs somewhere or something? Listen, I want you to know what I'm doing is that the first thing I'm gonna do on sabbatical is 2 weeks from today, my oldest daughter gets married. And so she's asked me not to officiate the wedding, but to just be dad. And that's what I'm planning on being. And then we're gonna do a little bit of travel with our middle daughter. Thank you. And then when we get back from that trip, I'm gonna get on a plane and go to Dallas for 2 days. I'm gonna sit in a room from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. with a facilitator, and we're gonna do what's called a life plan. And we're just gonna go way back and look at what God's been doing and unfolding in my life, the 50 years of life that I've had up to this point, so that way we can map out and pray over what the next 5 to 10 look like. And then I'm gonna actually late July just get away. By then, hopefully my jets have been cooled, and I just wanna listen. God, where do you want to lead your church? Where are we going in the next 5 years? I don't want to make plans and ask you to bless them. I want to ask you what your plans are and then get on board with that. And then I want to pray over sermon content, like lay out sermon series through Easter of 2028. And then I plan on taking a few righteous naps. That's what I plan on doing, all right? Now, listen. I know what some of you are thinking because I get this comment every time I do this. Here's what you might be thinking. Well, must be nice to take a sabbatical pastor. Wish I could take one of those. And first of all, if you thought that thought, totally understand that. If I could just maybe kind of gently respond to you. First of all, I will say this. It is nice. Actually, the word nice isn't what I would use. I would use the word blessing. That's a better word. Of which I want you to know, I have not asked for, I do not feel entitled to, and I do not take it lightly. I will say this, that I'm going to get to this in a minute, that I think you should take a sabbatical. I'm going to get to that in a minute. But I would tell you that, well, once again, when it comes to like not just the tangibles of the job, but like specifically with being a pastor, there's a spiritual weightiness to it that I think is important to understand. I do think that there's ups and downs to every job and career. Wouldn't you think that's true? I've read somewhere that like 80% of your job description, especially like if you're in a job that you enjoy, 80% you love and 20% you just kind of put up with. I think that's true probably generally for all of us. I know that's true for me. But I think that one of the things that might be different about being in full-time vocational ministry as opposed to any other very noble job, God can work through all of it, whether you're in the marketplace or you're a stay-at-home parent or whatever, is simply this differentiation, is that if you work a job in the marketplace, very likely your boss or your customer base or your board or your coworkers are not likely very interested in your spiritual health. Now, I don't mean to overstate that. Maybe you are in a marketplace job where they do, and that's great. But I would imagine that for many of you, you are highly discouraged from even talking about your spiritual life, let alone them checking in on your spiritual health. Now, the reason why I'm bringing that up is because in most normal like jobs, you can be struggling in your walk with God. You could be struggling personally with some issue in your life. Maybe it's a personal sin struggle or whatever. But just as long as you're hitting your numbers, getting your job done, it's likely not going to impact your employment, at least directly. But as a pastor, my and those in vocational ministry, one of the occupational job hazards that very few people talk about, and I think there's a reason why there's a high burnout rate, there's a reason why 40% of pastors have quit since COVID, there's a reason why there's lots of high moral and ethical failure, is when your spiritual health is directly connected to your livelihood, that's an occupational hazard. And you got to think very, very cautiously about that. And you got to have intentional time and care devoted to staying healthy and not getting wrapped up in your identity in the thing that you do. And a sabbatical is one of the tools to assist in staying healthy. So can I just say, yes, it is nice. And I'm extremely grateful for it. And I want you to know I will steward the time wisely as an investment into me and my family because, and by the way, the last time I took a sabbatical, I was on fumes. Like in 2021, when I took a sabbatical, when I walked out those doors, I wasn't sure I was coming back, to be quite honest. And so it took me a while just to kind of get filled up and recalibrated. I can say this to you confidently. I've been running hard this year, but I have never had more fun doing ministry than I am right now. I'm having the time of my life. And so I'm actually walking out these doors about 80, 85% full, which I'm really excited about because that means I don't have to spend like the next 3 or 4 weeks drooling on myself to like begin to feel like a human. So I plan on coming back and running and gunning and giving the rest of my life to this place. So thank you for granting this to me. So here's the second thing. Talked enough about me, I wanna talk about you. Secondly, if you thought, man, it must be nice, I wish I could. You should. Like if you're able, you should. Now, before you like immediately push back on me, I'm saying this, it's not only is it wise, but it's biblical. And maybe you are not in a job that allows that. I totally get that. Maybe you are in a season of life where you can't do that. Totally get that. I've been there before. But I will say this. One day you will. I don't know what that looks like, but one day you will. Maybe it's you are in a job that grants it, or maybe you're your own business owner and you can figure out how to get there. Or maybe this. Maybe you're in between careers. All of us will face that at least once or twice in our adult life. That would be a perfect time to do so. And sabbatical isn't just relegated to 12 weeks. Sabbatical is a concept. Rhythms of sabbatical rest. So if by chance you had the thought, man, it must be nice, wish I could do that, can I very lovingly ask you a direct question? How you doing with a Sabbath day? Like, let's start there. Like, is there a day right now during the week where you are intentionally Sabbathing, or are other things crowding in? Now listen, I get it, man. Busy schedules, busy seasons, got small kids at home, kids that are in travel sports. That's like a whole other thing. We could talk about that, but we won't. And it's like, man, I want to, but I can't. Now listen, maybe you're missing it on a weekly basis because life just happens. But if it's continual, 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 then you have nobody to blame but you. And so you gotta ask yourself, like, how do I begin to fight for this? You might write this phrase down. You need to divert daily. Divert is do something that's not work-related that replenishes and recharges you. Divert daily. Withdraw weekly. Withdraw. Sabbath, one day a week to disconnect and rest. Retreat monthly. This is this idea that I'm just gonna, on a quarterly basis or a monthly basis, I'm just gonna kind of get away for a half day somewhere and just try to recalibrate some things, and then abandon annually, get away for an extended time to vacation and rest to fully unplug. Here's the, I don't know what this looks like for you, but here's the question. Are you establishing rhythms of rest in your life? Now, some of you, your schedule maybe is like a dumpster fire right now, and you're gonna maybe actually need to have somebody that you invite in that speaks into this, a coach or a facilitator or somebody that helps you say no to some things. In fact, I've got like two or three people in my life right now that say no for me. It's great. I say yes, they say no. And maybe some of you, you're like, I'm a people pleaser. I just can't say no. We'll find somebody to say no for you. Like, I don't know what this looks like for you, and maybe you're not gonna get there overnight, but you gotta begin to intentionally figure it out so that you don't set yourself up for burnout. Because, yes, you were made for productivity. You were made to work hard, but you are like the car that you drive if you have a car. Is that a car? You don't purchase a car. A car was not made just to sit in the garage. A car was made to be on the road. But if you drive the car without ever servicing it or changing the oil or giving it gas, it will eventually end up in the ditch. And the same thing is true for you. And so you replenish so that you can stay on the road and continue to go. I've been planning this sabbatical for the last 2 years because I knew it was coming. And with the same intentionality, although not the same intensity, you may need to require some rhythms of rest in your life. So people and pressure are going to resist this, as we see in verse 33. Guys, we live in a society that does not look upon this very kindly. It says, now many saw them going and recognized them, and they ran there on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. So understand what's going on. 15,000 people are on the shore. Jesus says to the disciples, come on, let's go Sabbath. I've arranged a boat. And they get on the boat, and they cut a corner across the Sea of Galilee to another a beach line down the way. Is about 4 miles by boat. And the people know where they're going. Like, oh, they're going to Shangri-La. Oh, they're going to the resort. We know where they're going, come on. And so they run, it's an 8 mile run, but they know exactly where they're going, and they outran them to the place. So think about this, it's almost like a scene out of Monty Python or something. They get in the boat, they're like, come on, let's get away. And they turn around and there's all the people right there. And I would imagine that as they saw the shoreline and all those people gathered, the disciples were like, oh man, come on, man, we're trying to sabbatical. And then in verse 34, when he, referring to Jesus, went ashore and he saw the great crowd, he wasn't annoyed with them. He had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. This is an Old Testament picture used to describe God as a shepherd and people as helpless sheep. God described himself as a shepherd to Israel in Ezekiel 34, and Jesus is now living this out. And the idea is that people are helpless and starving, and it's almost as if Jesus could sense and had a healthy respect for the fact that they were in need. If you recall from a couple of weeks ago, Jesus was in his hometown of Nazareth, and he couldn't do anything there because the people had no hunger and no belief. In fact, they'd filled in the gaps with cynicism and suspicion, and he couldn't do anything there. So it's almost as if when Jesus sees a crowd of people that recognize their hunger and need, he wants to meet that need. And so Jesus is likely just as tired and in need of a Sabbath as the disciples, but his compassion for people prompted him to care for them. And it says in verse 35, when it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, this is a desolate place. In other words, there isn't anything open right now, Jesus. The hour is late. And it's not an unreasonable request that they say in verse 36. Send them away to go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat. See, the disciple, Jesus, is standing there teaching all the people, and the disciples are standing there, I don't know, in the water up to their knees, looking out there, looking at their watches. It's starting to get late. They're yawning. Jesus, come on, man. Like, can you scoot them on to a nearby village? Maybe, you know, they can get a Hampton Inn or something. Maybe we can resume this the next day. And Jesus' response to the disciples is not what you would think. In verse 37, he answered them, you give them something to eat. And they said to him, it's a question. And I think they asked it somewhat in an exasperated tone. Shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat? Translation, we're on sabbatical. And it's like, should we go buy 200 denarii? I don't know about you, but like, you know, you read 200 denarii, it's like, I don't know what that is. A denarius was equivalent to a day's pay for a worker. So essentially what Jesus just said to them is that it would take roughly 8 months of salary to make the 200 denarii. Don't you think that's a little bold and ridiculous of Jesus to ask? It's like, hey guys, you feed them. And they're like, Jesus, it would take 8 months pay to feed this crowd. That's crazy. That's unreasonable. And look at Jesus' response in verse 38. And he said to them, how many loaves do you have? In other words, he's going, well, what have you got? Now guys, I don't know about you, but I have read this passage hundreds and hundreds of times. I've preached this passage dozens and dozens of times. But for the very first time this last week when I was studying it and I came across that question, I laughed out loud. Because I mean, just look at it again. He's like 15,000 people in front of them. He's like, hey, send them away. And Jesus is like, well, you feed them. We don't have enough. And he's like, well, what have you got? Here's why I laughed. It's an irrelevant question. Does it matter what they have? There's 15,000 people in front of them. Does Jesus really think that they had enough chomp beef sticks, goldfish, and juice boxes in their backpack to feed the 15,000 people? Man, we're going to hear it in just a minute, and you likely know the story. They're going to say, well, we came up with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. What if they would have said, we have 100 loaves and 50 fishes? Would that have mattered? No. It's 15,000 people. Jesus asked this question knowing that what they had wasn't enough, and he asked it anyway. Listen, man, you make that application to your life. He's standing in front of you, and there's a need, or there's a calling, or there's a purpose you need to step into, and you're like, I don't know that I have enough. And Jesus is like, well, what have you got? It's an irrelevant question. Here's what I mean. Jesus, do you really think Jesus literally needed 5 loaves and 2 fish to feed the crowd? He didn't even need that. He could have just said, be filled. And everybody's stomach filled up. But he actually used the 5 loaves and 2 fish, and he used the disciples, and he wants to work through you as well. See, so many of us, we hold ourselves back from being available to God and being used by God because of our not enough, whatever that is, whatever you wrote on that paper, whatever your weakness is. You're like, God, I don't have enough time. I don't have enough money. I don't have enough ability. Here's the thing. He already knows you don't have enough of those things. You never will. It's not about those things. It's about your availability to God. And those things are standing in the way. Some of us are waiting to go on an adventure with God. And we're like, I'll take my faith really, really seriously. I'll get on board with what God wants to do. But let me graduate from high school or college first. Or let me get married first. Let me settle down first. Let's have kids first. Let's wait till the kids are grown. Let's wait till we get the kids graduated. Let's wait till retirement, financially secure. And we're waiting and we're waiting and we're waiting. And how tragic would it be that you get to the end of your life and you never made yourself available for God to use you because you were waiting to have enough and be enough. And all God wanted was, what's your 5 loaves and 2 fish? And you're like, well, that's embarrassing. I don't want to give God my 5 loaves and 2 fish. It's not enough. It's irrelevant. He doesn't need it. He wants you. He does not need what we have. He wants who you are. And he knows that often we are held back by what we have or don't have. So when you release that to him, he can work in it and through it. That's why Paul said, I'm gonna boast in my not enough. I'm gonna boast in my weakness, because then there is power for the power of Christ to work in me. Here's the question. Are you available right now to let God use you right where you're at with what you've got? I don't care your age. I don't care your financial resources. I don't care your marriage status. Right now, where you're at with what you've got, right now on this day, are you making it available to God? Well, the disciples, Jesus says, hey, go and see. The disciples, when they found out, they came back. They said, we have 5 loaves and 2 fish. Then he commanded all of them to sit down in groups on the green grass, and they sat down in groups by hundreds and by fifties. And taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. So he involved them in the miracle. And he divided the 2 fish among them all. That is a hilarious statement. 2 fish among 15,000 people. And they all ate and were satisfied. And they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and of the fish. And those who ate the loaves were 5,000 men. I love this so much. The fact that God would choose in the miracle to have 12 doggy bags left over. I'm going to feed you so full. There's no scarcity mindset here. I'm going to feed you so fully that you are stuffed, taking doggy bags home. Now, that's an incredible story. One of my favorites in the Bible. And as I mentioned to you, I've grown up in church, and I remember I've heard Sunday school lessons on this, sermons on this. But oftentimes, the preacher or the teacher gets the application wrong. And I want to be gentle in saying that. It's not a criticism towards them because I've done the same. I look back through my file. I've done it too. What I mean is that we place the emphasis on the wrong part of the application. We walk away going, oh, yeah, Jesus fed 15,000 people with a boy's Lunchable. That's amazing. Yeah, he did. But the deeper miracle here, the deeper application, is that Jesus used exhausted, insecure, inadequate disciples like you and me who are struggling with their not enoughs to participate in the miracle. And what he did then, he wants to do now. And the disciples, just think of any of the responses the disciples could have made to Jesus. Jesus, didn't you bring us out here to rest? Like, this is like the worst sabbatical ever. But in participating in the miracle, I bet you they woke up the next day replenished and refreshed. They were physically exhausted, emotionally depleted, spiritually fatigued, and painfully aware that what was being asked of them exceeded their enough. And that's the point. Because as long as you think you're enough or that it's up to you to have enough or be enough, you will never be fully dependent upon the one who actually is. So some of you walked in here today carrying the crushing burden of not enough. It's whatever you wrote on your paper. I don't know what it is, man. I'm not spiritual enough. I'm not smart enough, not successful enough, not attractive enough, not disciplined enough, not confident enough, not wanted enough, not useful enough. And Satan has convinced you that whatever's on that paper, your insufficiencies disqualify you, or here's the word, excuses you from being used by God. So you've been sitting on the sidelines for quite a while. And through scripture, God always, 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 I can't find an exception otherwise, where he uses people that were acutely aware of what they lacked. So God needed a spokesman, and Moses stuttered. God needed an army, and Gideon hid. God needed a woman with a pure heart, and Mary Magdalene had a past. David was the underdog. Peter was unpredictable. Paul had what he called a thorn in the flesh. Never once did God go to them and ask them to do something, and they're like, I don't think I can. I'm not enough. Never once did God go, well, I guess you're right. I'll keep interviewing a few more candidates and get back to you. No, he goes, you'll be perfect. You lean into that. See, here's the primary application of the message today. When you can surrender your not enough to a God who is enough in the hands of Jesus, that always becomes more than enough. It's just your availability to him, your 5 loaves and 2 fish, whatever that is, man. It's the passage we started with at the very beginning of this message, Paul's letter to the Corinthians in chapter 12, verse 9. God says to you, he wants to say to you right now, my grace is sufficient for you. My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in your not enough. So can you boast now? All the more gladly in your weaknesses so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. It's an invitation. It's the miracle of the body of Christ. He wants to make a difference in us for the purpose of making a difference through us. Now, ultimately, this miracle points beyond just a meal that satisfied a temporary hunger, because this crowd that went home with doggy bags, they were hungry 24 hours later. And Jesus didn't just come to give bread, he came to become bread. He would say in John chapter 6 that I am the bread of life, and whoever comes to me will never hunger. This crowd was physically hungry, but maybe today, right now, you are spiritually hungry, and that hunger drives you. That hunger, maybe right now, it drives you towards trying to satisfy it through your identity, whatever that is, whether that's your performance on a ball field or in an office, or maybe your sexuality. Like, you're like trying to satisfy this thing with food that won't. Or it's maybe it's worth, or it's approval, or success, or peace, or forgiveness, or rest. And we keep trying to feed ourselves with the wrong things. We keep running after achievement, or another relationship, or another dopamine hit, or our physical appearance, or prowess, or money, or attention. The word for this is idols, and our heart is an idol factory, trying to satisfy the thing that only God can. See, only Jesus can truly satisfy you, but you gotta be honest about your not enough. So the invitation today from Jesus isn't to know more, it's not to try harder, it's not to work longer, it's not to be more impressive, it's not any of those things, it is simply this. Would you bring me your not enough? Bring me what you got. All your weaknesses, your failure, your exhaustion, your shame, your insecurity and guilt, your 5 loaves and 2 fish. And he does not need what you have, he wants who you are. And for someone here today, your greatest limitation isn't your lack of enough. It's the illusion that God only uses people with enough. And that kind of thinking will keep you from the one who wants to be enough. And Jesus summarized it so well in Matthew 16. Whoever would save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Isn't that counterintuitive? Because we're trying to hold on to life. And he says, that'll slip through your fingers. Man, if you can let it go to me, I'll give you life to the full. Full surrender sounds super scary. In fact, that's maybe been part of the reason that's kept you back from giving your life to Jesus, because it's that full surrender part. But here's what you got to understand. Right now, you are fully surrendered to something. You're enslaved to something. And when you're enslaved to the wrong thing, that leads to more hunger and eventually death. But when you're enslaved to the one who died in your place, that leads to satisfaction and life. But you got to trust him. So would you come and fully surrender your not enough to the one who wants to be enough? And maybe for somebody here today, you need to give your life to Jesus. Fully, full on surrender. Because maybe what you did was lip service before, but now you need to move your feet. Maybe you've drifted from him, you need to bring it back. But the invitation for all of us is that you would take your not enough, whatever you wrote on that paper, and that you would come down front. There's something powerful whenever we can do something physical. And when we physically come down to an altar and just lay that thing down. We've got tables that have a candle on them at every location. We're gonna use this as an altar, and you just come down with your not enough, and you just simply lay it on the altar. Now, here's the thing, is that that's not gonna fix things. That's just symbolic of what you're doing. So some of you are gonna need to maybe write your not enough down on a paper and do this every day for a while. Physically, somewhere in your house, your backyard, something. Lay it down, lay it down, lay it down. Because here's the thing we do, is we'll write the thing on the paper and put it on the altar, and then we don't physically take it with us, but we take it right back up emotionally. And so you need to lay it down before him and invite the power of God into your weakness to watch what only he can. Father, we come to you right now, and we thank you that you are the God of enough. Forgive us when we don't believe you, and we try to fill that gap with achievement or appearance or finances or friends or likes and follows. God, I pray that we would be a people that trust you when you say, be vulnerable with me, that we can, and know that that's not gonna be used against us, and that we invite you into our weakness so that your power might flex in our lives. And so God, as we stand to our feet and as we worship and as we step out from where we are to bring our not enough down to the altar and lay it down, would there be something powerful and tangible that you would do through that simple movement by your Holy Spirit to break chains, to set us free, to offer forgiveness so that we can fully step in to who it is that you made us to be. Thank you for your grace. We don't deserve it, but we receive it.